Good evening, I am Josh Beiser, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. My guest tonight is a designer behind the very interesting audio experiences of Deep Sea, and he's currently working on Sound Self. Please welcome to the cast, Robin Arnett.
Hello.
Hi, Robin. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks.
All right. So, Robin, for your games, as we said, they're very interesting titles based around audio. I know a lot of people are probably familiar with Deep Sea, but for those who are tuning in who haven't heard of that before, could you tell us a little bit about that, as well as your background with game development?
Yeah, sure. Well, Deep Sea is a strange one. Deep Sea is an installation experience. You can't download it on PlayStation, you can't bring it onto your iPhone, it's an installation. I'm pretty sure the only place it's still playable is the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment in Oakland. Mm-hmm. So it's an audio-only experience where the player wears a gas mask that blinds them. And I designed it with... I was sort of exploring immersion, and I just wanted to understand how effectively I might be able to lift somebody from their current experience of reality and place them into a fictional one. And mm-hmm. So the whole design of Deep Sea is really focused on subverting your awareness of your surroundings and replacing it with something else. So I knew from my experience as a gamer, as somebody who plays video games, especially horror games, that fear is a very effective mechanism for sort of getting somebody to not second guess their intuition, mm-hmm. even though their intuition might be totally based on a fiction you're giving them. But the game is designed to use fear to kind of snap you out of your experience and put you somewhere else. And it wound up really working. It's a really, really scary experience. And somebody fainted playing it at South By, and that's sort of when I realized that the way I put it is I wanted to use my powers for good instead of evil. but it's also that I was just... I began to recognize that, okay, I'm using fear as a really effective tool here. But it's also a crutch, and I would like to, it was a couple of years later that I realized I'd like to, I'm still extremely interested in immersion and in getting somebody to leave their experience of reality behind, but I think Sound Self has a lot more substance to it. It's much more of a whole experience and instead of replacing a person's experience of the world with a fictional experience, as I was trying to do with Deep Sea, mm-hmm. I'm trying to replace a person's experience of the world and their self as they occupy the world with, I guess, void or nothingness or just floating awareness. So, Sound Self's been in development for about 3 years, where Deep Sea used fear to subvert a person's awareness. Sound Self uses trance and hypnosis. And where Deep Sea replaced that reality with a fiction, Sound Self sort of hypnotizes you into this strange, self-reflective space that's very difficult to describe.
All right, very interesting. I want to talk about Sound Self in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. I just want to stay on Deep Sea just for a few questions regarding horror design. It's interesting about creating that immersive experience of basically terrifying the player. It's something that we've been seeing a little bit more of these last few years in terms of indie horror games. The Five Nights at Freddy's series has been really capitalizing on putting the player into like a very oppressive environment and then just assaulting them with jump scares and whatnot. When you were coming up with the concept for Deep Sea, did the original idea was focused on horror, or did it sort of develop as you were coming up and putting it all together?
Well, so horror was not... When I was first thinking about the design of Deep Sea, it wasn't thinking, okay, I'm going to create a horror experience. I was thinking, I'm going to experiment. Because I wasn't even really thinking about the experience I was making. This was never a game that was going to ship or anything. It was an art project, and for mm-hmm. me, more importantly, it was an experiment.
Okay.
So I was asking myself the question, what could I do to create as immersive an experience as possible, to completely subvert a player's experience of reality as fully as possible. And fear, horror, emerged as a useful tool for that. It's by no means something I'm particularly interested in. It was just a way to leverage the player's consciousness.
All right, got it. Now, you've been working on SoundCell for the last few years, and you said that it's offering a different experience. It won't be on fear. It's going to try to take the player to another state of mind and just another experience. So could you go into a little bit more detail about what makes SoundCell such a unique game experience for the player?
Yeah, I can try. You know, it's an interesting project because, and I try to avoid sort of going into this kind of conversation about it because it's so difficult to describe the experience. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, if somebody takes a large dose of mushrooms or LSD or something and comes out of that, you can't possibly describe the experience with words because you're experiencing something that that you just can't encapsulate in language. SoundCell was actually inspired in large part by an experience I had on mushrooms, and on LSD, and I realized that the particular my cat really wants to go outside. It's okay, you can stay inside. And I recognized that the sort of unfolding of reality I experienced was something that I could trigger with game mechanics. Mm-hmm. So I just can't describe what the experience is. You know, it's impossible, and I'm sort of done trying to describe what the experience is. You go in there, you lose yourself for a while, and you come back, and my hope is that when you come back, you can't quite take your reality in the way that you're used to experiencing it for granted anymore. And the way this works is, the way you interact with SoundCell is with your voice. You're not trying to control anything. You're not trying to win. It's not a goal-oriented experience. It really is just a tight feedback loop between your voice and the audiovisual experience. So as you hum or chant or whatever, SoundCell will resonate with your voice and harmonize with your voice and create music around your voice and visualizations with that. And it winds up being kind of a synesthetic experience, and bit by bit your senses just sort of mesh together, and you stop thinking, and you're just there, just whacked down in the present, experiencing whatever it is you're experiencing in there. Then you come back.
All right. Sounds very interesting. And again, this is one of those game design concepts that would probably never work in like the traditional AA or AAA market space. For you, Robin, as an indie developer, I just want to get your thoughts on how has it been working in the indie space these last few years? Because we've seen the indie market really shift and change so much lately.
I don't really think about the indie market. Mm-hmm. It's just not super interesting to me. You know, I think about what I'm trying to make, and if what I were trying to make were something that would work best in a museum somewhere, I'd be making an art installation. But and that's what I did with Deep Sea, right? Mm-hmm. But I chose the limitation going into SoundCell of creating something that a lot of people could play, so using consumer hardware. And I don't really think about the market, right? I guess to a degree I have to. There's a part of it that's interesting, but I don't know, I don't know how SoundCell fits into the story of indie games more than anything else, right? You know, mm-hmm. indie game developers, it's a community, we're all talking, we're all getting advice from one another, we all inspire one another. SoundCell is itself inspired by Proteus in a very, very large way. Mm-hmm. Pixel Junk 4AM in another way. And like the last minute and a half of Fez, right? So we're all inspired by each other, but I'm not thinking of SoundCell in the context of all these other games that are working on mm-hmm. until I switch into the mode of trying to ship the game and get the story out there. And at that point, it's not really about SoundCell as an indie game. It's about SoundCell as an experience that video games have not formally been able to really facilitate. And this is, I mean, this is what I love about indie games and the indie game community. It's everybody's trying to do totally bizarre, crazy things. Some people are trying to do totally bizarre, crazy things within a particular genre. And some people are trying to really break out of genre altogether and just create something true from their heart. I mean, we're all creating stuff that's true from our heart, but I think Sound Self is a really unique project. And it's not unique in being unique. There's tons of games coming out in the indie sphere, especially with virtual reality just coming out, that are just as unique and crazy as Sound Self, but they're unique and crazy in different ways.
Yeah,
Sound Self really tackles or tries to tackle consciousness directly, and gameplay is secondary to that.
Excuse me,
I've got allergies.
I'm more than aware of that. I'm pretty much allergic to outside, so I definitely feel you there. So with Sound Self and creating a unique experience, again, this is something that we really have heard a lot from indie developers about. And that also brings me to an interesting question that I'm not sure if you've thought about this before in the past, but there's also been the growing debate over what is and what isn't a video game. Now, we see this with a lot of games that focus on a story or a narrative experience, stuff like Gone Home, Dear Esther, The Stanley Parable, etc. And there's definitely an interesting discussion regarding how would you define a video game? Because that title or that mode or model has really changed over these years, especially when we look at a game like Sound Self, which, as you said, Robin, is something that you're aiming for this very unique auditory experience that wouldn't really be possible anywhere else or even be something that most people could experience on their own. So for you, Robin, regarding that type of question, what do you think about this whole debate of trying to define a video game or trying to qualify an experience?
I think it's a complete waste of air. Like, complete and utter waste of air. What is? I mean, I used to find this. No, I never really found it interesting, but I used to like, because Sound Self really pushes those borders of what a video game might be, and that's interesting, right, to a certain degree. But I don't know. It's not a useful question, right? You engage with an interactive experience or any experience of art. Right, and then you get to the question of like, what is or what isn't art? And I mean, does it matter? We have a subjective experience of art. We have a subjective experience of how we engage with any kind of art we love. And video games are just a kind of art that you love and that I love. So if I'm engaging with an interactive piece and it's enriching and meaningful to me, I mean, I don't care what it's called. I'm getting an experience of it. And the only reason the question is what is or is not a video game is useful is because I guess people like to draw a boundary around the stuff that they're interested in, so that you know, and that's natural, so that like I'm interested in video games, like I like playing video games, and so if I'm going out in the world and looking for something that's going to interest me, if I'm looking for video games, that's going to be helpful for me just to frame research and to frame my conversations with people and what have you. However, my boundary of what I mean by video games is completely different from somebody else's boundary of what they mean by video games. And so looking for an absolute definition of what a video game is completely useless and misses the whole point of what makes art special, which is that it's unique to every single one of us. We each have a unique experience with it. We each have a unique experience with what moves us and with what doesn't move us. So, like, is Sound Self a video game? Is it not? Or not? You know, I think that depends on the player. Is it art or not? I think it depends on the player.
All right. Yep, and again, it's definitely one of those discussions that we hear from a lot of people, especially a lot of older gamers who grew up playing more, I guess I would say, linear or straightforward titles. The NES era, etc.
And you think the useful question here, you know, it's like this isn't a debate that people are having, you know. I think people, anybody who is really considering this question, and I don't mean this critically, but I think, like, ask yourself, what are you asking this question for, you know? Like, what value or what are you searching for in asking this question? Is it to define the boundaries of a space to legitimize things and not legitimize other things? Or is it to help frame your understanding and help you find something for yourself, right? And I think, like, you don't have to go too far with that line of self-investigation to find that the real question is probably not what is or what is not a video game. The real question is probably something that, again, is going to be different from person to person. But I think the question, what is or is not a video game, is sort of a distraction from from more interesting things. And as long as you're thinking about, like, what is or is not a video game, you can't see past the label of video game into the implications of the hardware, the implications of the way interactivity affects your mind. You know, all you're interfacing with is this word video game, which is a word that's used to describe a bajillion things. But if you have any real interest in video game, you know, go beyond that word and actually investigate what's interesting to you, right? And to me, that's consciousness, that's interactivity, that's synesthesia, and video game is a mechanism for me to activate these sorts of things, but video game is not really the active operating word for me. And I think for most players, you know, unless you're talking about community, right? And I think this is the case with a lot of people. If you have 100 people or 1,000 people or 100,000 people who all share an interest in something, then you know, you want to know that you're interested in the same thing, right? And so video game is perhaps a good macro word for that. But if you're letting that word stop you from discovering things that maybe are just what you're looking for, or if you're letting that word sort of stop you from investigating what it actually is about video games that interests you, then I think it's not serving. And I think video game, the word video game, is already maturing past the point of its usefulness, especially with virtual reality, just on the cusp.
Yeah, definitely. And virtual reality is definitely taking things into very interesting directions, such as your game Sound Self, and just a lot of the movement we're seeing in terms of developing new VR technology. The Rift is slowly but surely making its way into the retail space, hopefully at some point this year. And as you say, Robin, it's a good point regarding the original definition of a video game cannot apply anymore in today's space, just due to...
Well, let me ask you, what is the original definition?
I believe the original one, when I looked it up like a few years ago, had something to do with a electronic software that was designed to engage, or designed to challenge the player. I'll have to look that up again quickly. Well, it's been a few years.
No, I mean, you don't need to, you know, but just again, like, to what degree is this boundary useful? And to what degree is a particular definition?
Exactly. Now, as we've talked about over the last few minutes, Robin, that your focus is on delivering unique experiences to the player, are there any other developers with titles similar or that go in interesting directions that you follow, that you would enjoy, that our audience may be interested in as well?
Oh, yeah. I'm very fond of the work of Fernando Romaggio. He makes Panoramical, which is a really cool musical experience. I'm very interested in how the music game genre is evolving and how people are making different kinds of music creation experiences that don't necessarily, you know, that don't require musical skill. I mean, even the Guitar Hero and Rock Band games are, I mean, Harmonix is, they're a big company, but they're ingenious. They're really brilliant and really inventive, and I love the designers there. And I'm seeing a lot of musically inclined game artists making powerful abstract experiences. And I say abstract experience, they're not, these experiences are not necessarily fully abstract, right? But music is an abstract form that engages us in a way that we can't really put into words, and as soon as you start putting into the words and intellectualizing, you're breaking it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of projects that are taking the music game genre in particular in really interesting directions. I just saw the EGW, the Experimental Gameplay Sessions at GDC this year, a game called Thumper, which looks really freaking cool.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see, other projects. I don't know. I've been kind of keeping my head under a rock and just working. I really haven't been playing many video games lately because I've been so focused on the development of Sound Self and my personal stuff.
All right. Are you familiar with the developer Tale of Tales by any chance?
Oh yeah, I love those guys. They're great.
Yeah, they've been putting out just some very interesting games. I know The Path, they just did one, Luxuria Superbia.
Luxuria Superbia. That game's amazing.
Yeah, thank you for being able to pronounce that, because I don't think I would be able to do that on my own.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, Robin, that you mention Harmonix with the Guitar Hero and Rock Band series, because we've been seeing, as you said, a small resurgence in the music platform. I know they recently announced that they were going to get back into it with a new Rock Band title. And that's...
Well, they never left. They never left.
Yeah.
And I don't see a resurgence. I see sort of continual evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
I was just going to say, from a market perspective, it did seem that, at least among the mainstream consumers, that the music genre did sort of die a little bit over the last few years, just due to, I would say, just a complete overwhelming of the hardware and the peripheral costs involved in having to keep buying these new pieces.
I think that that's maybe hardware dependent music games,
mm-hmm.
specifically, but you know, at the same time, you had like the Trip Runner and the mm-hmm. Runner series,
yeah.
Which I guess don't have as big an audience as Harmonix does, but I don't know. I'm in this space where, again, I'm really not thinking about market. I'm thinking about mm-hmm. the work that artists are putting out, and all I see is just lots and lots and lots of beautiful, smart things being made. Samantha Kalman has been working on a really beautiful music creation game called, kind of music puzzler game called, why am I forgetting the name of this game? I'm going to quickly look this up.
All right.
Centris. It's Centris.
Okay.
So I just see innovation everywhere. And I guess I see your point about hardware, but it's kind of hard for me to see that because my lens is from a place where I just see what people are making. There's lots of cool stuff.
Awesome. All right. With that, speaking about people doing very interesting experiences and pretty much expanding the market, I think that's a good segue into talking about a few of the major trends that have happened in the game industry over the last few years. And I just want to get your thoughts on them, Robin. And I think the first one would probably be crowdfunding. This is something that we like to talk to a lot of our developer guests about, because it is such a recent addition to game development and has really made a mark so quickly over the last few years. Now, with SoundSelf, I know you did do a Kickstarter for that, and I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on this platform when it comes to game development?
Well, for me, and again, like, I can comment on sort of overall market stuff, but there's people out there who I think can speak much more eloquently and honestly from a more informed place than I can. But I can certainly speak from what it means as an artist. And
mm-hmm.
what it means as an artist is, so going in, so this was 2 years ago that we did our Kickstarter, and we're super, super late getting our rewards out to people, which super sucks.
mm-hmm.
But we did our Kickstarter about 2 years ago, and at the time, you know, I had this weird idea. I didn't, for SoundSelf, right? And I didn't really know at the time where this would go.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a full design in my head. I had a core interaction of how this would work. But everything else around it and the more fleshed out experience that it is now just didn't exist at the time because there's been so much experimentation going on. And I knew this would be a really big project, and I knew it would be a very niche, very strange project, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, doing the Kickstarter, we raised $36,000 on that Kickstarter, which is not enough to fund the game, but it is enough to Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's called Kickstarter. And that we raised that money, and that we raised that money from as many people as we did, it was something like 1,100 or 1,200, demonstrated there is an audience for this, demonstrated mm-hmm. there is interest in this. And that, like, I don't anticipate coming out, because it's such a niche game, because it's so strange, because it's so unusual, I don't anticipate SoundSelf being a big moneymaker, right? But mm-hmm. we're pouring a lot of time into this project, and we needed to know at the beginning, you know, is this at least going to be worth it? Is this at least going to, because if you're putting tons and tons and tons of hours in and then nobody plays it, then, like, sure, you got a huge learning adventure out of it and you grew a lot. And, like, for me, you know, I've learned a ton about consciousness and hypnosis from working on this game. Mm-hmm. But if there's not a market for it, if people aren't going to play it, then it's not worth it. All that. And so I think the most important thing from our Kickstarter was it gave us the confidence to really charge forward. And when you have a small team, that confidence is glue that keeps you together yeah. and keeps your stamina up. It gave us an audience, which is really helpful for testing ideas against, for helping spread the word. And that $36,000 is not nothing. I mean, minus fees and minus, like, some of that went to a Burning Man installation, that's like probably $25,000 or so, minus taxes, you know. That was enough to, you know, take us, to pay my programmer for a little bit and, then to take SoundSelf out to different festivals and, meet more people and make more contacts and stuff. So, Kickstarter and crowdfunding in general, I guess, for me, really enabled this project altogether. I don't see, without crowdfunding, I mean, the money was never the thing holding us back, but without crowdfunding and without the ability to test the idea in a very real way, in a will you fit your dollars sort of way, without that, I don't think we would have had the confidence to charge forward and spend 3 years making such a niche and weird experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what you just said, Robin, regarding using crowdfunding to basically test the waters and build yourself an audience during development is such a very important part of crowdfunding, and something that we hear from a lot of our other developer guests who come on, regarding being able to, as you said, get that confidence needed to build your game, because traditionally you would build your game in a vacuum, you know, over 1 to 3 years with no real interaction with the outside, and then you're basically just, you know, sending it out into the water and seeing if it floats. But today, with Kickstarter early access and just the level of transparency we're now getting with game development and talking to developers like yourself, it's becoming a lot easier to really get that audience and get that space developed so that when your game is ready to go and it is launched, you already have a huge stable fan base who are interested and involved and want to see that game succeed.
Yeah. And I think it also gives, I can go to Kickstarter right now and find out exactly. Like, I have backed, as a backer, login button, login with Facebook. Let's see, let's go. Okay, how many projects have I backed? I have backed something like 40 projects, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And as a backer, you know, I feel 42 projects, yeah. I get to feel like I'm really participating in this project. Like, I'm really getting to shape the landscape and make projects happen that I think deserve to happen. And I think maybe, like, a quarter or so of these projects never really went through, but, like, it doesn't really matter, you know? It's, Because for me, when I'm supporting a project, I just want to create a relationship with the person making it, and you know, let them know that I've got their back, and here's some money to prove it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And go make your project. That sounds beautiful. I think there's a much more meaningful interaction there than your normal transactional interaction between consumer and game maker. It's not transactional.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, aspects of it are transactional, but it's more intimate.
Yeah.
And art making, like I was saying at the beginning, you know, is it a game? Is it art? Who cares? It's personal.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to make the interaction with the creation of the project for that to be more personal as well, I think that matters. I think that really matters to people, especially with art, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because the project itself and your interaction with the project itself is going to be so personal.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense that there's value to the backer in having a more personal relationship with the project.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really, you know, like for me as a Kickstarter creator, that can be difficult because I really want to treat my backers super well. They've made so much of this possible, and sometimes like actually making the game can get in the way of meeting backer expectations, right? Like we said we will be finishing this game in like a year, and 2 years later, and we're going to finish it at some point in the future. Yeah, but it's really difficult. And that's difficult, but the interaction is still very personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really sort of different role between consumer and creator, or a different relationship between consumer and creator. And I think that is beautiful and valuable.
Yep, definitely. And as you said, keeping your fan base, or keeping your Kickstarter backers in the loop, keeping them invested in your project, is such an important part that we're seeing now with people who go to Kickstarter or just go with any form of crowdfunding, such as early access. And as you said, it's not really a quote-unquote transactional experience or a transactional method compared to the old days of I go to a store, I give $60, I get a game. Now it's I give someone money to hopefully be able to produce an idea or an experience that they want to make. And you really do see that with a lot of the more successful Kickstarters. They're able to convey that passion that they want to make this. This is not a project that they want to... I'm sorry. This is not a project that the original goal is to make, you know, millions and millions of dollars on. This is a project that they really want to make because they believe in it. And they want to hopefully get that message across to all the backers and anyone on Kickstarter looking at this project.
Yeah.
All right. Now, this next question, as you said, Robin, I know that you're not keeping too focused on like the market and just the game industry trends as a whole, but I just want to get a quick read on this. And that's just regarding Kickstarter's viability in the future. After the success of SoundSelf, we've been seeing the Kickstarter platform as a whole suffer a little bit of consumer confidence dropping, with some of the major projects either not coming out or not meeting expectations. And this is another one of those questions I like to ask all of our developers who come on, and I just want to get your thoughts. Do you think that Kickstarter or crowdfunding in general will remain a viable option for game developers in the future? Or do you think that something will have to change in order to, I guess, essentially keep up with the times?
Well, I mean, yes and yes. Crowdfunding is valuable. Crowdfunding is valuable to consumers. It's valuable to creators. It allows for a really granular market where a lot of different needs are being met and a lot of different projects are being created. So I don't think anything's going to happen to crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so valuable, and because I think, like, yeah, a lot of big game projects have fallen through, and that really sucks.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been a little bit of a loss of consumer confidence, but I don't think that means that crowdfunding is going anywhere. I think that just means that people are going to be more realistic about their expectations of what crowdfunding means, which is, like, it's not a promise, it's not a pre-sale, it's a risk, and you're taking a risk with the developer, right? You're risking your money, and supporting project, and developer is risking their time and their money. I don't think crowdfunding's going anywhere, but will it have to change? Absolutely. That's just how these things work, you know. Kickstarter, Indiegogo, these are first generations. I don't know what the next generation is going to look like. But I also, like, I do think that there's sort of a I think we're kind of seeing the late stages of capitalism as we know it. How is exchanging goods for currency for services, and how is that going to exist as a system when the singularity happens in like 50 years or 60 years or whatever, right? You know? And I think crowdfunding is, and again, we're right at the beginning of it, so I'm very hesitant to make any big claims or anything, because I really don't know. But I mean, it looks to me like crowdfunding is kind of a peek at how capitalism is evolving and might continue to evolve, right? Evolution just happens. Change just happens. Will crowdfunding have to change? Absolutely. I don't know how that's going to be, but but change is just change is the only unchanger.
Very good point, Robin. I agree with you about that. I mean, we've seen, it's been just about 3 years since Kickstarter really blew up thanks to Double Fine, and we're still sort of going through the mass change that has done, and we still have 5 years left in this decade. It will be very interesting to see just where we go from this point. And as you said, Robin, it's probably going to have to change, but who here really knows what it's going to be like in the next 5 or even 10 years from now?
Yeah, there's people who are a lot more informed on this than I am. And, you know, I'm sure there are people out there who actually have a pretty good idea of what it's going to look like, or a pretty good guess. But I can't, you know, pretend to.
All right. So I think with that, let's move on to probably our final topic for this cast today, Robin, and that's talking a little bit more about VR, what that means for game development, and sort of how it's sort of coming back into our lives and into game design as a whole. I remember back in the 90s when VR first started to come up, and it was going to be, you know, the quote-unquote future. You know, everyone was talking about it was going to be the next big thing. And then just the hardware costs and really the lack of, I guess, an end game for what they were going to do with it, it just killed VR for the mainstream market. And now we're starting to see it come back in a big way with the Rift and with how a lot of developers are now embracing not just VR, but the new hardware to create very unique experiences, just like SoundSelf with you, Robin. And we're seeing a lot more, I guess, future innovations with technology. My friend Ken, who comes on sometimes, he is a huge supporter of VR. He has, I think, the DK2. He has the Omni treadmill. He's got probably a whole bunch of other stuff all trying to create that perfect experience. So I think I have an idea of what your answer is going to be to this, but for you, Robin, what do you make of how VR and the Rift is starting to come back into our lives?
Well, I'm a believer. It really works. It's very, very powerful hardware, and I think, you know, so the question is, what does virtual reality mean for video games, right? And I think this question, this is a question I get asked a lot, and I really want to reframe it, because I think if there's one thing I want your audience to take away from my thoughts on VR, just my little picture from inside this VR world, is that VR is not a platform. Virtual reality is not a platform for video games. Virtual reality is just like cinema in its early days, is not a platform for photography and theater, right? And in the early days of cinema, they kind of tried to treat cinema as a new medium for theater, and it was just like a a really shitty container for theater. Mm-hmm. And then it discovered, oh wow, cinema is its own medium, it's its own thing, right? And now you use moving pictures for conveying safety information to passengers on a plane as well. So I think one thing that I really want to inspire people to see is that virtual reality is not a platform for video games. Mm-hmm. Virtual reality is a new medium. And sure, in the first decade of virtual reality, we're going to be seeing a lot of things that look like video games mm-hmm. on virtual reality. And it's really easy to get confused about that and be like, oh yeah, it's just hardware for video games. But it's so much more than that. I mean, the ability to really convincingly and compellingly transport a person to whatever environment. Mm-hmm. As soon as designers start asking the question like, oh, I don't need to transport a person to an environment that is remotely realistic, in quotes, right? It doesn't need to obey the same laws of the universe as this one. I think we're really going to be seeing virtual reality as sort of a personal reality transformation tool. And sometimes, yeah, that'll be containers for entertainment media that maybe look like video games, maybe look like movies. But we're also going to see a lot of just totally radical stuff that we can't possibly imagine right now. And I'm very fortunate in being in the space where I am, where I played a bunch of really cool experiences. I felt very moved by some of these experiences. I'm creating what I think is one of the biggest leaps away from traditional video games, from virtual reality right now. And I say that not as like, you know, an ego boosting thing, but I just think that's what SoundSelf is. It's a really big leap mm-hmm. In some direction or another. And man, I'm really excited. I'm really excited to play what people have coming up. I played with an experience called Tilt Brush just a couple weeks ago, which is you just have a paintbrush in your hand and you just paint in midair. Oh. And it's the most magical thing. It is so magical. It is so much more magical and compelling and just awe-inspiring than any video game I've ever played. Mm-hmm. Yeah, VR is freaking cool, man. But just like, you know, we were talking about with crowdfunding, virtual reality is also, I mean, in some ways it's not young. In some ways people have been trying to do virtual reality since the 60s and 70s, right? And mm-hmm. and in some ways they worked, in some ways they didn't. And right, you were talking about a resurgence in the 90s. And I really believe that this time it's coming and staying for good. And that means that this next 10 years, people are going to be fumbling and tripping over themselves and making experiences that are jaw-droppingly, surprisingly amazing and totally unprecedented, and that 10 years later are going to seem utterly quaint. Mm-hmm. I think that about SoundSelf as well. I think in 10 years, SoundSelf is probably going to seem totally quaint. Mm-hmm. That's just where we are.
Yeah.
Things that, you know, we're going to go, like, you go into, you see people come out of these virtual reality headsets and they're like, whoa, it's so real, you know, in 10 years. People are going to put on these virtual reality headsets that we're using and be like, whoa, this is weird, and I can't believe people thought this felt so real back then, because their bar will be higher than ours is right now. Mm-hmm. And their bar for what they expect from their experiences are higher. Like this Tilt Brush experience that I played it's the first of its kind. It's the MS Paint of virtual reality art creation experiences, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's not freaking amazing, yeah, but it gives me a lot of hope for where this stuff's going. As once we start to enter our toddler years and figure out how to walk on our own without the same inherited assumptions from video games, from the medium that so many of us making virtual reality sort of came from.
And that game does sound really amazing to have that virtual experience with being able to, as you said, just paint in midair. That sounds very fantastic.
Yeah, it's magical.
Yeah.
It's totally magical.
And I want to go back to what you just said a few moments ago, Robin, regarding treating virtual reality as its own platform as opposed to treating it as an extension of a video game. because that, I think, is a really good point to go on, especially as talk begins to develop more and more about bringing virtual reality to the mainstream audience and bringing it beyond just the hardcore or just the supporters of the Kickstarter and the crowdfunding. And my next question for you, Robin, is for people listening to this cast who have mainly focused on the Rift and VR from a video game standpoint, are there any examples or things that you've been seeing besides Tilt Rush of a practical application or a unique use of the Rift or virtual reality?
It's hard for me to make recommendations because most things I've played are so clearly in their infancy.
Mm-hmm.
They're not mature yet, and so I can't make a really firm this thing is definitely worth trying. This thing is definitely worth trying. Because most things I try are like, okay, this is interesting. I can see how with another 2 to 5 years of iteration on this, this is going to be really special. But honestly, for the most part, most stuff I've played with, and I haven't played tons of stuff, just because I've been keeping my head under a rock and focusing on SoundCell.
Mm-hmm.
And even SoundCell, if you play the current build of SoundCell, yeah, I mean, it's really buggy and slow, and mm-hmm. and hopefully in a few months we'll be in a place where it'll be totally as majestic as I promise it is. It's hard. Like I've played some Ambient Flight, and that's really nice. You just get to be a bird and fly around. Mm-hmm. There's all these games that kind of... Oh, and of course, Valkyrie is freaking awesome. That's a really good straight up video game as well. Mm-hmm. Made by the CCP, I think, the people who make Eve Online.
Okay.
That's a really, really mature experience. The thing to keep in mind is that most experiences for VR right now are not mature.
Yeah.
And by mature, I mean they haven't gone through sufficient iteration, experimentation, development to kind of walk on their own. So, I mean, Tilt Rush is a really mature experience. It stands on its own. It works really effectively. It's beautiful. It's perfect. Valkyrie works on its own. It's beautiful. It's perfect. I think SoundCell does as well. Not right now while it runs at 20 frames per second, but I think the design of SoundCell is mature for virtual reality as a medium. Unfortunately, most stuff being designed for virtual reality right now inherits a lot from that I played anyway. Inherits a lot from the video game roots that are just sort of clumsy. And I don't want to name specific games, but it's just like, I'll tell you, actually, another really fun experience for VR is Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes. I don't think it's as mature and perfect as Valkyrie, for example, but it's a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I play that, and I'm like, wow, if this is step one, I can't wait to see what step three or step 10 is going to be. I think that's the thing with virtual reality right now, is there's a lot of really cool baby steps. There's a lot of really cool, really weird ideas. Some of them work amazingly. Most of them work well enough for you to see how cool this stuff's going to be in a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Or less than that. 3 years, 5 years.
All right.
As soon as enough things have been published that just don't work for us to learn. Mm-hmm. Right? You're going to see a ton of first-person shooter games come out on VR. The thing with first-person shooter games is that, I mean, it just doesn't work very well in virtual reality. You get nauseous, you get tired and dizzy, mm-hmm. you're moving your head a lot more than is comfortable. The first-person shooter genre is going to have to evolve drastically. It's such that it's no longer even recognizable in order to function on virtual reality.
Yeah. That is a really good point, Rob, regarding traditional first-person shooters or what we're seeing in the market today. I mean, just thinking about it in my own experience, I could not imagine someone playing like a very twitch-heavy shooter with like VR or the Rift. I mean, I'm getting a headache just thinking about it. Like trying to keep your head focused doing the insanity of Call of Duty or Team Fortress. We would need to really just radically shift it in order for it to really just be something someone could actually experience without throwing up after like 20 minutes of play.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, another...
Or even if people aren't like nauseous, right? You know, even when we get past the point of nausea, it's still not going to be a comfortable experience.
Yeah. Now, speaking about VR in its infancy, and as you said, regarding taking these baby steps forward in terms of what works and what doesn't, in terms of the other interesting like hardware and technological advance that we're seeing, stuff like the STEM controller, are there any other like pieces of hardware that you've been seeing that you're very interested to see how it will expand or how it will grow over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, nothing being used in gaming hardware, right? But EEGs, electroencephalogram something, basically headsets that record brain activity. These are becoming cheap enough to, there's no reason you couldn't integrate them into a headset, into a virtual reality headset. And I suspect that within 10 years, you'll see people doing that, which means that you'll have neural feedback baked into as an available peripheral for your software designers, right? So that's something I think the things I'm most excited about are biofeedback, which unfortunately controller designers don't seem to be taking seriously yet. Most game designers don't seem to be taking very seriously yet. Although there are some really cool experiments out there that are using biofeedback. Valve's doing some really cool stuff that internally, there's a lot of cool indie things that happen that are fun biofeedback experiences. But I think once biofeedback becomes just a little bit cheaper and more importantly a little more mainstream, we're going to see interactive experiences that can afford to be a lot more subtle in their interaction, a lot more. So, like, take SoundSelf, for example. SoundSelf is a game. We're using vocal input. If you think about what it's like to control a game with your hands, it's precise. It's deliberate, intentional. It is execution-oriented. And this is great, but it engages your mind in a certain way. In fact, it engages your mind at all. Once you have biofeedback as your primary interaction, which it is in SoundSelf. We are, by asking the player to use their voice, we indirectly get breathing information, which we're using as a very important control in quotes, but a very important input into the experience. And the result is, it's not an execution-oriented experience. It's not a mind-oriented experience. It is a kind of feeling-oriented experience, or a just a being-oriented experience, a self-recognition experience, one that doesn't even make sense in the vocabulary of mind-oriented experiences or intention-oriented experiences like you might have with any controller-based input. So, once you can really, like there's no reason you couldn't get galvanic skin response installed into a handheld controller, right? And then you have direct access to how tense a person is. The only reason is that it's sort of outside of the boundaries of what we call game design and of what people think they want. And I think as soon as we see, really, I think it's more of a cultural shift than a hardware shift, because the hardware is already cheap enough. Galvanic skin response is cheap. Electroencephalograms are cheap. As soon as we have a culture for designing interactive experiences around this high latency, reflective input, I think we're going to be seeing a lot of really, really interesting projects that absolutely don't fit the paradigm of games right now. But that's going to require a cultural shift.
Definitely great points about what we've been seeing or what we're going to be seeing with VR. And I know we could spend the next 45 minutes to an hour talking more about the intricacies of the new platform, but I know you have to get going in a few minutes, and I just have a few just quick questions just to wrap up our talk on VR, and then we will say our goodbye. This next set of questions, I just want to get your thoughts on, Because I just want to see what are your impressions on some of the reservations a lot of people, including myself, have on VR, as you said, slowly but surely becoming a new platform or a new medium for the future. The first one, and this is one that I'm sort of hung up on, and I've spoken to a lot of more mainstream developers who are also wondering about this, is in terms of pricing. As we've seen, the price for what the Rift is going to aim for, they're trying to aim to get as cheap as possible so that it will be adopted by the mainstream. But there's definitely some thoughts as to whether or not the mainstream audience will be willing to try out this very new medium. So what are your thoughts on trying to get the mainstream people interested in trying the Rift for the first time?
I think just time.
Mm-hmm.
I think you know, if you don't want a first generation product because you don't want to pay more to see earlier content, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. No,
I wasn't an early adopter of the iPhone, but I have one now.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how it's going to be. You know, to some people, it is so worth it. Gamers are. Everyone's different in what they can afford, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some gamers will spend $90 on a precision mouse or whatever, right? $250 or is not an absurd amount of money for a peripheral that gives you access to the kind of content that virtual reality does, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
it's expensive, and it's an expensive risk, but, like, you look at the cost of the first iPhone, you look at the cost of any of these things, it's just, like, that's what it is. It's expensive, you're taking a risk with your money because maybe that risk is worth it to you. But maybe it's not, and if it's not, that's fine. You know, smartphones are ubiquitous now, and I don't think anybody who has a smartphone now would begrudge somebody who didn't buy the first generation of smartphones because it didn't meet their needs and it wasn't worth it. That's just how it is for some people. And that's inevitable. That's going to be the case, right? It's too expensive for you and it's not worth it to you because, you know, maybe you want to spend less money in 5 years to play experiences that are more polished. Then that's a perfectly reasonable choice, I think.
All right. I'm going to assume this next question, I think I know what your answer is going to be, but I just want to ask it. So do you think that the mainstream audience will be interested in adopting VR, or do you think there will be some growing pains over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
And again, you know, mm-hmm. I think smartphones are a really good comparison here. The market for smartphones when the iPhone was launched was huge. Not as big as it is now, but big. You know, there's enough people who are really excited about this to, I think, validate the kind of investment that's been put into this space. I think there's huge interest. And it is bound to only grow. And I believe that in 10 years, virtual reality is going to be, maybe not as ubiquitous as a smartphone, but pretty ubiquitous. And the road from obscurity to ubiquity is, sure, there's going to be growing pains, and sure, things are going to change, and sure, the experiences you can have with your smartphone now are miles more mature than the experiences you can have on your smartphone when the smartphone first came out.
Yeah.
I think that's just the way it is.
Yep, I agree with you on that, Robin. I think smartphone, just the adoption of phones, sort of the cell phone first to the mainstream market, has just been huge. I mean, again, I grew up back in the 90s when we didn't have cell phones, at least in terms of being a standardized form for all the mainstream market. And then we saw that shift to smartphones over the last decade. And of course, there were growing pains with the model. First generations obviously didn't have the same capabilities what we have today, but now when we look at today's world, a smartphone has really become almost second nature to a lot of people. And again, a lot of people are now growing up with smartphones. I think that's going to be a big deal. Just like with VR and the Rift, the first generation, there's probably going to be some problems, there's going to be some growing pains, but it will eventually reach a point where people are going to be growing up with this new platform, and it's going to become, hopefully, adopted much like the smartphones as, you know, a part of our daily life or our daily routine.
Yep, I agree.
All right, so I think with that, we're going to wrap things up. Again, we could probably sit here and talk about VR and just the developing market and platform for, you know, who knows how many hours today. But I know that you have to get going, Robin, and it has been an absolute pleasure meeting with you tonight. And I hope that SoundSelf will do well for you, or at least start raising a lot of interesting questions and experiences for your audience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's already doing that. It's already been a success for me. You know, I go into this stuff sort of hoping to learn, and I've learned a lot. So, yeah, I have high hopes. I think, you know, we'll see. And thank you. Thank you very much for your interest.
Not a problem. Now, you said earlier in the cast that you're hoping to have a better version or a more updated version in the next few months. Do you have any clear ideas of when it will be released, or is it still too soon to tell?
Too soon to make commitments.
Awesome.
But, you know, I don't want to tease and then have to untease.
Yeah, definitely. We've seen that.
I mean, people can pre-order now. They can buy into the alpha now. We've actually got a build right now that's super stable, and we just need to put it up on the server. So that's something that'll happen probably this week. So, if people want to support the development and buy the alpha, that's sort of part of how we keep operating. Mm-hmm. And you can do that at soundselfgame.com.
All right. And are you planning on putting SoundSelf on any other digital platforms like Steam, GOG, etc.?
Well, we're definitely going to be on Steam. Mm-hmm. We're looking at, we talked about the Oculus Quest right now, but we have talked about PlayStation 4 and Morpheus. And Morpheus is definitely something we're looking at. We've been looking at making a version for mobile devices, for virtual reality on mobile devices, but that has proven to be quite difficult, so that's a little bit on the back burner for now. But yeah, it's going to be PC, Mac, Linux, Steam, Oculus Store, and probably Morpheus as well.
Okay, cool. And I think with that, Robin, my final question for today's cast is, do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to the fans listening?
No, just thank you for listening. And I hope my thoughts are worth your time listening. Thanks for tuning in.
Great. All right. So again, Robin, it was a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully we can talk in a few months, either more about VR or more about what you're currently doing with SoundSelf or anything else.
All right. Thanks so much.
Not a problem, Robin. So for those of you listening, we're going to wrap things up for today's episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. And as always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, there are several options available. To write a guest post for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted. To donate to our Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding for the site, you can find all that information under the Patreon banner on the front page. And make sure to tune in to my daily Let's Plays and live streams of various games. You can check that out on Twitch under my handle of GWBicer. And that will also be posted on the Game Wisdom YouTube page, which you can find just simply by typing in Game Wisdom. And we'll hopefully have a link to that very soon. So, thanks again for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you real soon. Take care, everybody.